Last week, in his Dharma talk, Joshin spoke about this paradox he has of feeling that on one hand he has nothing to talk about, and then on the other hand, knowing that he has to say something. And a little bit later in that talk, he mentioned that for most of us, when we do decide to say something about a particular topic, we're most often speaking from our own particular view. And in that regard, he went on to mention Bernie Glassman's oft-quoted refrain, "It's just your opinion, man." You know, Bernie often said that line with a bit of a mischievous grin on his face. And you can feel there's a little thread of humor that's kind of woven into that phrase. And yet, at the same time, I found myself kind of internally hoisting a little red or maybe just a yellow flag of warning, that a phrase like that can sometimes too easily allow me to dismiss the power of my views and opinions. And let me clarify that I don't think Joshin was using Bernie's refrain frivolously, but he and I have sometimes, you know, both mentioned to one another that we feel uncomfortable at the ways in which certain Zen one-liners, like fold it all into your practice, or not knowing is most intimate, or it is what it is. You know, these things can be tossed about like so much meaningless jargon and kind of misused in an attempt to give the impression that complex and uncomfortable situations can somehow be neatly wrapped up with a cute little Zen phrase bow. So coincidentally, in Eve Marco's blog yesterday, she mentioned this exact concern of mine when she wrote, and here Eve is commenting on her attempts to convince her mother that she, Eve, is right about something. And she writes, "You would think that with a mother in dementia, that I would have figured out that a long time ago, but the old habit of trying to persuade someone that I'm right and she or he is wrong doesn't die easily in me. I've made a long career out of arguing. Again and again, I see that if I can let go of my ideas just a little bit and listen deeply to someone else's needs and claims, perhaps something will arise that will take care of both of us. It's a long, tough road. Often I'm reminded of Bernie's teaching, 'It's just your opinion, man.' He expounded on it in his book with Jeff Bridges, The Dude and the Zen Master. But I think that for many people, it sounded a little too dismissive, too lightweight, because it didn't seem to address the pain and suffering that sometimes lies behind our stories, our memories, and belief systems. I was abused, or I was neglected. I was hurt and wounded. I went through trauma. What do you mean? It's just my opinion. You call suffering an opinion?" End quote. Those last few sentences that she writes, you know, really hit the nail on the head for me, because I think there are degrees of harm that can ensue from our views. The views we have about whether or not the toilet paper roll gets mounted to the, you know, rod so that the toilet paper unfolds over the top or under the roll, or the view we cling to that the top sheet goes on the bed with the pattern side facing up, or maybe for you it's down, or how the dishwasher gets loaded, or where the silverware gets placed next to the plate in the table setting. You know, these are little views. We get attached to them, yes. And we can sometimes very vociferously argue our rightness, you know, in our particular viewpoint. But I'm okay with kidding around about these opinions, because I just think there's just not a lot of harm that can come out of that. But there are a number of our views that are not so laughable. The next level for me becomes the views that I hold about me, my, and mine. And this gets a little more serious for us, right? Our views about ownership, about what's ours, about what people can borrow from us or what we'll lend to them or what we'll share with them, either materially or sometimes even emotionally. Our opinions about who we like and who we don't like and why. Our views about to whom we think we can speak harshly and it's okay, and to whom we think we need to speak politely in order to keep up appearances. And then we can go up another level, and our views can begin to determine who's deserving of housing or health care, personal safety or respectful treatment, who gets labeled an alien, a foreigner, an immigrant, a native, an entitled slacker. Whose natural resources are we entitled to? In whose country can we justify regime change? And then we can go up another notch. And because of our view, we can butcher one another with unbelievable brutality, killing tens of thousands in a senseless war. Investigating view, or what's known as samadhi in Pali or in Buddhism, it's a highly salient undertaking when you're treading the Eightfold Path. Our views are conditioned by culture and family, religion and political leanings, etc. And of course, our views condition other things in return. In contrast to common thinking, view or position isn't just a simple collection of some abstract propositions, but it is actually an energetically and emotionally charged interpretation of experience that will both shape thought and action. Having particular views isn't of itself considered some kind of hindrance on the path. It's the attachment to those views that is the problem, even if those views might be considered morally correct. When the Buddha noted view as the first limb of the Eightfold Path, he wasn't so much interested in the content of your positions and your theories, but he was interested in the psychological state when you hold to them. So, for instance, you can see how when I think something should be mine, it can give rise to the mind of greed. When I think you're a foreigner or an alien or you shouldn't be in my country, it's underpinned by the mind of ill will. And when I'm believing in conspiracy theories that, people are running child sex abuse rings out of pizza parlors, I'm giving rise to a mind of confusion. So when I first heard the term right view, I assumed that it referred to a kind of a morally correct outlook or attitude. And while that's not completely off the mark, it's a little bit too simplistic. My task in understanding right view is not to discover the right one and then hold on to that. Instead, as Stephen Batchelor points out, samadhi, or right view, might more accurately be translated as complete view. Okay, having the total picture. And I think we've all experienced at one time or another having a strong belief in the truth of someone's side of the story, and then upon hearing a different participant's version of that same story, we alter our stance because all of a sudden we feel like we have a more complete picture, right? So I want to tell a story which I think kind of is a little bit of a long story, but I think it illustrates both how view can affect speech, the words and the kinds of descriptions we use for things. And it also speaks to how view can narrow our vision so that there are places that are left out or people that are left out. And I think you'll see from this. Anyways, it's a story about a woman named Marti Peel, who some of you may know. She is and was an active environmentalist, naturalist, someone who was very connected into the natural world. And she was engaged in environmental work in Alaska and Washington for many years. And she recounts the story of some of her work in Alaska, her environmental work in Alaska. And she says, quote, "We spoke all the time of losing this battle against logging on Kuya Island, or winning the fight against dumping mining effluent into Berners Bay. We would congratulate ourselves for outnumbering the opposition at public hearings. We knew how many congressmen or legislators were in our camp, and how many we needed to win over to our side on any given vote. Our strategic thinkers knew where the weakest link was in the opposition's case, or they would coach us to go for the jugular. We disparaged the oil company executives as we listened to their rationale for drilling in the coastal plains of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and we felt absolutely justified in our vilification of the Fish and Game Commissioner's proposal to hunt whole wolf packs with AK-47s from helicopters. We were at war, and the veterans had their war stories. In 1986, while Marty was working for the Northern Alaska Environmental Center in Fairbanks, the organization was suing the Alaskan Department of Environmental Conservation for failure to enforce existing water quality regulations. At issue was chronic sediment and arsenic discharge from placer mining operations upstream from an Athabascan village. The Environmental Center was not suing the miners, and it was not advocating enactment of any more stringent regulations. It was simply insisting that the state enforce the existing regulations. And the Northern Center won the lawsuit. The following day, a woman came into the front room of the little house in which the center operated. She had two children in tow. They came in and stood there between the shelves of t-shirts and note cards and the old metal desk, and she said, "Okay, you won, so now you feed them." These were the children of a miner whose work had been suspended because the Northern Center had won that lawsuit against the state of Alaska. The woman who brought the children in so that the environmentalists could see them was their mother. Marty remembers, "I had to stop and sit down. I knew that maybe I could bake bread for them every week, but I knew that wasn't what she meant. She needed more than my generosity. They needed my understanding, and they needed a way to support themselves. I began to see that there was no value in winning the environmental battles, lawsuit by lawsuit and bill by bill, if hunger, bitterness, and hatred flowed in the wake of justice. I began to have a sense of my own insensitivity to other people, and to see the despair and anger that had grown in the absence of personal contact. I began to see that while the environmental community, that the environmental community was losing ground, even as we were winning it in the courts. I think it was Norman Fisher who told me that he once heard a rabbi say, "There are three sides to every story. There's your side, there's their side, and then there's the truth." But I think that's what I'm being tasked to discern when I seek to practice right view. Do I have the complete picture? Or am I under the influence of some self-serving idea or some sloppy critical thinking? There can be huge and harmful consequences to this kind of investigative laziness on my part. I think the Buddha is asking us to be more philosophical about the opinions we hold, to look more closely at what we think, to inquire more critically into why we think what we do. Thich Nhat Hanh would often urge his students to constantly ask themselves, "Am I sure?" before acting upon a perceived certainty. He reminded us all that we're often misperceiving people's motives, their actions, their speech, in light of our own underlying tendencies to greed, ill will, confusion, me, mine. We're being cautioned not so much about the content of our perceptions, but about the ramifications for ourselves and others when we fixate upon a version of the truth or reality. I think that when the Buddha defined views as wrong or right, he was not so much expounding a moralistic or dogmatic way of looking at the world, but he was suggesting that certain views can lead to suffering and others to the end of suffering. Thus, right view is leading us ultimately not to the holding of correct views, but to a kind of detached form of cognition. Or as Nagarjuna stated, the best view is no view. I'm kind of struck by there's a few well-known Zen koans that kind of illustrate this dilemma of fixed views, somewhat humorous way, I think, and how these fixed views can really limit our appropriate response. And I'll share a couple that you'll probably recognize. Nanin, a Japanese master during the Meiji era in 1868 to 1912, received a university professor who came to inquire about Zen, and Nanin served tea. He poured his visitor's cup full and then kept on pouring. The professor watched the overflow until he could no longer restrain himself, whereupon he shouted, "It's over full. No more'll go in." "Like this cup," Nanin said, "you are full of your own opinions and speculations. How can I show you Zen unless you first empty your cup?" This is a classic Zen koan, and it speaks to this importance of what happens when we hold on to our learned ideas, whether we can hold them lightly and be willing to unlearn or relearn, free from fixed thinking or not. So what we are trying to pour out of the cup of our minds is our ego's attachment to our own experience and memory, and to a release of our fixed opinions and rigid expectations. Another story, also one that you probably have heard before. Tanzan and Aikido were once traveling together down a muddy road. A heavy rain was still falling. And coming around the bend, they met a lovely girl in a silk kimono and sash who was unable to cross the intersection, for it was completely overcome by a large puddle of muddy water. "Come, girl," said Tanzan at once, and lifting her in his arms, he carried her over the mud. His fellow monk Aikido did not speak again until that night when they reached a lodging temple. Then he could no longer restrain himself. "We monks," he said, "are forbidden to go near females, and especially young and lovely ones. Why did you not follow your instructions?" "I left that girl hours ago," said Tanzan. "Are you still carrying her?" I particularly like this story at this time, since we're getting ready to begin our annual exploration of the Zen Peacemaker precepts with Sangha members who will be committing to Jukai in October. And often the precepts are initially kind of misconstrued by those new to them as somehow bordering more on oaths or commandments. But in fact, the precepts are designed to be lived and embodied in the context of the reality of your life's unfolding circumstances. Life is, counterintuitively, situational. The human condition is never cut and dried. Sometimes the right thing to do is the wrong thing according to convention. Sometimes morality is just as muddy as the road that Tanzan and Aikido were traveling down. And going on a little bit more about this benefit of not becoming too attached to the precepts, you know, with rigidity or with a fixed view, Zen teacher Maureen Stewart wrote, "All the precepts are contained in what we're doing. This is our zazen, and this is our everyday life, every minute. So the power of this practice we are engaged in helps us to keep the precepts without self-consciously trying to follow a set of rules. If we try to do it, if we think about it, if we read the list of precepts every morning and say, okay, now I mustn't do this and I mustn't do that, it doesn't really work. But if it comes from deep in our center, from the intuitive wisdom mind, then it can be done. We can control ourselves very well when we are without any idea of controlling at all. There's really nothing to do and nothing to control and nothing to follow. Without trying to do something, we simply practice in the same way as when we are hungry, we eat, when we're tired, we rest. The precepts are not some rigid formulation outside of ourselves. She goes on, Hui Neng had an awakening when he heard the words from the Diamond Sutra, depending on nothing, realize your own mind. We are so often depending on this religion or that, or this ism or that. Don't even think about Buddhism. The true Buddhist would never say, I am a Buddhist. We are people who are practicing this universal principle with everybody else in the whole cosmos. There's no label, no separation, no statement like I'm a Buddhist, you're a Christian. True Buddhism embraces the whole universe without a single label. You must have your own experience of the study and practice, not think thoughts that have been given to you by anyone else. Depend upon yourself. Your own experience of your inner self is what this is all about. So I just want to encourage us to maybe recommit ourselves to a little more rigorous examination of our views and positions. To occasionally ask ourselves the question, am I sure? Do I have a complete picture? What am I practicing when I'm holding this point of view? What is being solidified in me, or what is being unbound? Can I truly live more of my life from the place of not knowing? Can I push back the horizons of my view and go beyond? Can I open the doors and windows of this dwelling that I call me and let in more diverse voices and experiences? I really believe that our very survival on this planet, our children and grandchildren's ability to ever know peace in their lifetimes, this unquestionable need for tolerance, acceptance, and appreciation of diverse species and cultures is needed to ensure a healthy future. And it depends in a great part on our willingness to enter wholeheartedly into this practice of right view.